a 180 degree turn on his part from where he started.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't say it better myself. It's a complete departure from the mission of the Post, and democracy dies in darkness. Well, now it's completely dark, and what do we have left?
That's the motto of the Washington Post.
Yes, that's the motto of the Washington Post. Exactly. And it's really, yeah, it's indescribable. And I really feel for my Post colleagues who now have to show up and work in a carcass of what this incredible institution was. The Post was such a special culture. It was different from any other newsroom I've worked in, where it was deeply collaborative. Desks were not competing for each other. Everyone was there for the same mission, which was to put out the best report. And they've completely dismantled that. And again, it's a deep disservice to any of our readers, to our public. And it shows the fragility of these institutions and how important it is to protect them, because with one fell swoop and a horrific layoff, 30-minute robotic meeting in which our publisher was not even present. We saw that our publisher, Will Lewis, was at some Super Bowl-related event. They didn't have the dignity to look us in the eye. You know, people got these mass emails, your job is eliminated.
You were told not to come to work yesterday.
We were all told not to come to work. We had an 8:30 a.m. Zoom, which in itself is inconscionable. And then after that, employees who even had, 27 plus years of service were told they lost their job in a one-line email where our publisher, again, was not present. This, again, really shows the lack of leadership at the Post.
Well, we're going to continue to cover the story and continue to cover the corporate media and remind people Democracy Now! Is independent. Nilu Tabrizi, just laid out from The Washington Post, will stay with us as we talk about Iran next. And Karen Attia, we thank you so much for joining us, former global opinion editor for The Washington Post. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the talks in Oman around Iran, between the United States and Iran. And then we'll talk about Gaza. Stay with us.
Nobody dares to exist in a greeting, a connecting glance. Life is just a jaded game to them. They will give it a chance. But you know and I know that the galaxies are all around us. And life will flow on. As long as the grass grows and the water runs. And while I'm here on earth, I rejoice in its worth. Cause freedom is free.
Batman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Iran. After weeks of escalating tensions, U.S. and Iranian officials have begun talks over Iran's nuclear program in Muscat, Oman today. Today's negotiations to stave off another conflict are the first between the two countries since President Trump ordered airstrikes against Iran's nuclear sites during Israel's 12-day war with Iran last June. Middle East Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner are participating in the talks, which are being mediated by Oman. The White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told reporters Thursday that for President Trump, diplomacy is always his first option, whether dealing with allies or adversaries. But over the past month, President Trump has also openly called for regime change in Iran and described sending an armada of U.S. warships to the Persian Gulf. At the height of Iran's crackdown on popular protests in January, he threatened to attack Iran to support the protests. On Wednesday, Trump renewed his threat, speaking to NBC's Tom Yamas.
Should the supreme leader in Iran be worried right now?
I would say he should be very worried, yeah. He should be.
For more on the prospects of these negotiations and the tense situation on the ground in Iran, We continue with Nilou Tabrizi. She was the investigative reporter covering Iran for The Washington Post. They just laid her off yesterday in the mass layoff. We're also joined here in New York by Arang Keshavarzian, professor of Middle East and Islamic Studies at New York University. Award-winning author of the books Bazaar and State in Iran and Making Space for the Gulf, Histories of Regionalism in the Middle East. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes at this moment, but we want to ask you about the significance of these talks, of President Trump's threat to attack Iran, and the possibility of diplomacy.
Thank you for having me. Yes, as you explained, this is a very strange and contradictory situation. On the one hand, there are these negotiations, first time in several months. It does seem both parties are interested. Donald Trump has repeated that he would like to have a negotiated settlement around the nuclear issue. But it comes right after 7 months of where the United States engaged in military attack against Iran, as you mentioned. But maybe more importantly, it's after yet another cycle of a brave Iranian protesters taking to the streets in late December and January that was yet again brutally repressed, with thousands killed, imprisoned, injured, and so on and so forth. So for both the Iranian state, but more importantly for Iranian people, it's very unclear what all of this portends, especially since it doesn't seem like these negotiations will go beyond the question of the nuclear program.
And, Professor, I'm wondering, you're probably aware that Drop Site News is reporting that senior U.S. military officials have informed the leadership of a key U.S. ally in the Middle East that the president could authorize a U.S. attack this weekend. Wondering your assessment of this dual policy of Trump, on the one hand saying let's talk, on the other side amassing this armada again and threatening a direct attack.
Yeah, so there's echoes of obviously what happened in Venezuela these past few months. So you have this talk of negotiations, but all of these threats. But I also want to point out that we're in a moment where there's a real deep information war, where there are many interested parties, governments, and opposition groups that are trying to feed information, misinformation. It's a very confusing part. And it should be noted that for people inside Iran who are under still a internet blackout, it's very confusing. They don't know what pieces of information to believe, what not to believe. Is there a war on the horizon, or are these negotiations going to actually reach a sort of a real meaningful conclusion? But we are in a information war as well as a threat of a real kinetic war.
And Nilou Tabrizi, I wanted to ask you as well, the recent protests, of course, the Iranian government has said that the unrest was being manipulated by Israel and that there have been some reports of Mossad infiltrating Iran. Could you, from what you saw on the ground, was there any indication that some of these protests may have been, in one sense or another, manipulated by outside powers?
No, that is a refrain that we heard, you know, very often. I think it goes back to, you know, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo coming out and telling Iranian protesters, you know, Happy New Year, Mossad is on the streets with you. That I don't, based on the visuals that we were investigating, there's no validity to that statement. If only comments like that from Western leaders make it exceptionally more dangerous for protesters on the ground. When I spoke with people who were protesting on the streets, they said that security forces on, you know, big speakers would say, anyone out on the street is a terrorist, and we're going to respond to you as such. That helps us understand the brutality if the state is going to label civilians out on the streets fighting for a better future as terrorists, and partially because the West is saying, hey, Mossad is there. We need to understand how dangerous that is for protesters.
I wanted to ask you, in the context of history, the Dulles brothers in 1953, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, head of the CIA and Secretary of State, sending in Teddy Roosevelt's grandson and overthrowing the Democratic elected leader Mohammad Mossadegh, basically on behalf of BP.
Yes.
Right through to now, what it would mean, regime change, and Trump saying, well, he said he was doing it for the protesters if he was to push and actually achieve regime change. Now it's talking about the nuclear program. But we talked to so many activists and academics who are saying, although they are very much against the regime, they don't want the U.S. involved in attacking and removing that regime, that they see this as a popular movement.
This is absolutely a popular movement. I think that is really important. We need to give the agency to the Iranians who are on the streets fighting for a better future. This is absolutely a popular movement. And we can measure that based on the spread, geographically, how many people were involved, and even with the mass arrest, if more than 50,000 people have been arrested, I mean, this points to this being absolutely a grassroots movement.
How many people do you think have died?
Well, these numbers are still in flux, but one of the best documentation groups, Hrana, human rights activist news agency, they said that just about 7,000, they have confirmed deaths, and there are more than 11,000 under review. They update these tolls daily.
And Professor Keshavarzian, your sense of what the peace movement and those who want to reduce conflict in the world should be doing at this time in terms of Iran?
Yeah, I want to underline what Nilu just said. I mean, I think as progressives in the United States or in the broader outside of Iran, we should be able to hold two truths at the same time. Absolutely, war. U.S. intervention is destructive. It's counterproductive. It hurts, actually, the most vulnerable in Iran, protesters and others, just like the sanctions have. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge and listen to the large number of Iranians from all different segments and sectors of society that not only this past few months, but for now over 10 years, have been engaging in various forms of protest, whether it's economic issues, whether it's demanding accountability and responsiveness from their rulers. They have been making this demand. And the Islamic Republic's social base has been whittled away gradually but systematically for over the past 15 years. It is vulnerable, but a U.S. intervention is going to be counterproductive to all of this.
Arayan Keshavarzian, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Professor of Middle Eastern Islamic Studies at New York University. We hope to have you on soon again. And Nilu Tabrizi, investigative reporter covering Iran, just let go from The Washington Post as part of the massive layoff of more than 300 journalists, about a third of The Washington Post staff. You will both be speaking together on a panel at NYU Wednesday, February 11th. Coming up, we look at why Human Rights Watch blocked a release of a report on the right of return of Palestinians. And we look on the ground at what's happening in Gaza today. Stay with us.
Because the ocean is all around us, and life will flow on. As long as there are ripples in the waves and the sun rays from the sun. And while I'm here on earth, I rejoice and swear. Cause freedom is free.
Freedom is Free by Chicano Batman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a discussion of Human Rights Watch on the Palestinian right of return. Earlier this week, the two-person Israel-Palestine team at Human Rights Watch announced they're resigning after HRW's new leadership blocked a report which called Israel's denial of Palestinian refugees the right of return a crime against humanity. The team had interviewed 53 refugees in camps across Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon for the stalled report, connecting the expulsions of Palestinians in 1948 all the way to the present moment. Omar Shakir, who headed the team for nearly a decade, and assistant researcher Milena Ansari, in separate resignation letters, suggested the decision to pull the report just before its scheduled publication came from a fear of political backlash. In an email to staff last week, Human Rights Watch's new executive director insisted the disagreement was not over the Palestinian right of return. In a statement sent to Jewish Currents and The Guardian, Human Rights Watch said, quote, "In our review process, we concluded aspects of the research and the factual basis for our legal conclusions needed to be strengthened to meet Human Rights Watch's high standards. For that reason, the publication of the report was paused pending further analysis and research," unquote. For more, we're joined by two guests. Joining us from Amman, Jordan, Omar Shakir just resigned as the Israel-Palestine director at Human Rights Watch. And we're joined by Kenneth Roth, former executive director of Human Rights Watch. He's author of Righting Wrongs, Three Decades on the Front Lines, Battling Abusive Governments. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! We know you've worked together for a long time when Ken was head of Human Rights Watch and Omar, you were head of the Israel-Palestine division. But you differ on that report right now. Omar, I'd like you to start off by saying what you were presenting in this report and why you feel HRW blocked it.
This report was assessing the Israeli government's denial of the right of return on Palestinian refugees. It was coming in the context, of course, of the mass ethnic cleansing and forced displacement of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. The idea here was to connect the erasure of camps in Gaza with the emptying of camps in the West Bank, with the attacks on UNRWA and the longstanding denial of return, and to take stock at this moment where many Palestinians speak of a second Nakba, to understand the lessons of the first one, because the legal architecture of denial of return was not built in 1948. It was built in 1949 to 1952. So we wrote a report and went through the normal Human Rights Watch process. It was signed off by all the relevant departments, including the legal department. It was put on the website, back end of the website. It was translated to multiple languages. External partners were briefed. And on the eve of its release, our new executive director pulled the report. He provided nothing in writing to explain that decision. And to this date, nothing has been put in writing. And I've done dozens of reports like this, and I've never seen anything like this in the organization's history. But my engagement with senior staffers made very clear that really the overriding concern here was a concern of being seen as challenging a political preference with no basis in international law. The idea of maintaining the Jewishness of the Israeli state, one of course forged through ethnic cleansing and maintained through apartheid. And in this case, that concern trumped calling for the fundamental rights of Palestinians to return to their home. And ultimately, after giving a decade for this organization, I did not feel I could continue to do so when I had lost faith in our new leadership's fidelity to the integrity of what we do best, which is to publish the facts that we document and consistently apply the law.
So, Omar, what you're saying then is that what Human Rights Watch is saying, that, quote, various staff members expressed concern with the report during the review, but that it took the arrival of the new executive director to exert leadership. Were there concerns expressed by other staff previous to your completion of the report?
Look, any report that Human Rights Watch issues, there's going to be concerns raised by different people. But at Human Rights Watch, there's a deference to expertise. And in this case, the report spent 7 months in review. It was signed off on by the Middle East Division, by all experts in their expertise, the Women's Rights Division, the Children's Rights Division, the Refugee Rights Division, the International Justice Division, and the Legal Office, and the Program Office, and it was set for release. And that was over a seven-month process. So were there concerns raised during this time? Yeah. I mean, the program reviewer, when he signed off on the report, said it's a fantastic report, the law is clear, it works well in this format. His one concern was how we can better prepare ourselves to address detractors saying that we're calling to end the Jewish state. And when it went through legal review again, they said this is the correct law. We've applied it before, including in the context of the Chagos Islands in 2023. And the report was signed off on and was slated for release, and we briefed external partners until new leadership came in. And of course, these other concerns bubbled to the surface. And the report was pulled without anything being put in writing. And I should note again that that happened in late November. For the next 6 weeks, I tried very much to engage. And they eventually later said, well, we have some concern about the legal framing. So we offered numerous ways forward that would address the stated legal concerns, including to base the finding on a different crime against humanity, which is transparently clear. And they said no, that this did not address the concern around advocacy, which had been communicated to me by the chief advocacy officer before as being about the Jewish state. And therefore, they wouldn't even allow edits to be made for the report and to be put back in review. I was told you either narrow the determination in a way that has no basis in fact or law, or the report's not coming out. So I tendered my resignation.
I want to bring Ken Roth into this conversation. Omar, your resignation comes as HRW's new executive director, Philippe Lopian, begins his tenure. Well, the former Executive Director of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, has rejected your claims of politically motivated censorship. He's been quoted in The Guardian and The New York Times and Jewish Currents. He said, quote, that you tried to fast talk through the review system at a time of leadership transition and extreme interpretation of the law that was indefensible. But Ken Roth, you've just arrived in Pakistan right now. Can you explain why you are critical of the report, you who have approved so many of Omar Shakir's reports?
Yes, Amy, good to be here. You know, it is odd being here because usually I'm lambasted for being too critical of Israel. But, you know, my first principle in dealing with issues of Israel and Palestine is to be scrupulously accurate in applying the facts and the law. And to be honest, you know, if I were still executive director, this report would never have gotten past me. You know, I was always an integral part of the review process. I worked with Omar extensively. The apartheid report that Omar initially drafted, you know, when it came to me, it was utterly unpublishable. And I had to go through three detailed edits before we put out a report that was very strong and that was unimpeachable. The Israeli government didn't know what to do with it. We strengthened the report by making sure that we accurately applied the law and the facts. And that's just not the case here. I mean, the issue here is actually not the right to return. Human Rights Watch has endorsed the right to return for three decades. The issue is whether you call the denial of the right to return a crime against humanity. And that's a brand new theory. There is one case on this point vaguely by the International Criminal Court in the case of the Rohingya. And it said two things of note. I mean, one is that they can return to their country. It didn't even specify an area. And so, you know, it's unclear in the report, I don't think even addresses this, you know, what is the relevant country here? Is it Palestine or Israel? But more to the point, in the case of the Rohingya, there was extreme suffering. They are not recognized as refugees. They're denied the right to formally work. They can't educate their children in the Bangladeshi system. So this is severe. And the court said in that context, you might rise to the great suffering requirement before you can call a right to return a crime against humanity. Now, can you say that here for the 6 million Palestinian refugees? I mean, you know, many are citizens in Jordan. They're leading ordinary lives. You know, some are in the United States. Is somebody in Detroit, you know, still suffering so greatly that it's a crime against humanity not to let them return? I mean, I happen to be in Lahore, Pakistan right now. You know, at the same time as the Nakba took place of the Palestinians in 1948, here there were 400,000 Hindus and Sikhs who were forcibly expelled. I mean, people would laugh at me if they said it was a crime against humanity that Pakistan is not letting them return now, you know, 70-some years later. So, you know, this is a complicated issue. So when Philippe Lopinion came in, I mean, Omar did benefit from this leadership gap. When he came in and played the role that I would have played, he said, this can't go forward. You can't possibly put forward a report like this, which is just so shoddy in terms of the applying the complicated sets of facts to this brand new legal theory. It's got to go back to the drawing board and be approved, which is exactly what I would have done. So, you know, to say that this is, you know, some big censorship thing is crazy. I mean, it would have been a non-issue if I was there because I would have still been part of the review process. When Philippe arrives and does the same thing, suddenly Omar, you know, wants to fall on his sword and pretend that this is like some great censorship disaster. It isn't. The aim here is to put out a report that is defensible.
You're both lawyers. Omar Shakir, your response.
Look, I mean, Ken is overlooking the fact that Human Rights Watch, in the context of the Chagos Islands in 2023, set out very clearly that denial of return amounts to a crime against humanity. So if what Ken is saying is accurate, that the legal theory is unsupported and untested, Human Rights Watch should do something it's never done in its history, which is to retract that report. It's a matter of consistency for us. If in that report we laid out a legal theory, it has to be applied here. The points that Ken make are actually not the arguments that Human Rights Watch has made. They have made arguments saying, well, you know, the facts actual research could be much stronger, because everything that Ken laid out regarding the harm of the Rohingya in Myanmar, you have with Palestinians. Let's remember, you have generations of refugees, you know, fathers and grandfathers that live their life as refugees, that don't have the right to work, that don't have citizenship, that face restrictions on all aspects of their everyday life. And it stems at root from the fact that the Israeli government denies them the right to return to their homeland, disconnects them, severs them, the anguish of being disconnected from your land. And by the way, we heard these testimonies from Palestinians in Gaza who are now in Egypt, who wanted to return amid a genocide to their land, to their streets, to their neighborhoods. Imagine that pain over the course of many, many generations. That anguish clearly meets the threshold of a crime against humanity. And let's remember, I mean, Ken hasn't read the report. We wouldn't even cite Ken's testimony in a report because it's all secondhand and it's not based on having seen the report directly. Here, the difference between when Ken was executive director is he would read a report, he would make comments, we would have a back and forth like we had here, and we would arrive at a good place. In this particular case, you know, Philippe came in, he made a decision, nothing was put in writing, there was no chance to directly engage. We offered to make edits to address any concerns, including to base it on a separate crime against humanity of persecution, which is straightforward. Severe abuse of fundamental rights with a discriminatory intent. Right of return is fundamental, it's severe, it's multiple generations, and it's discriminatory. Jewish citizens of other countries can go to Israel and become citizens. And we were told nothing about the law at that point. The only argument was the advocacy concerns. And that's really the key point here. Amy, Human Rights Watch's credibility is we release our reports no matter what they are. We did it on October 7th, even though there wasn't a really good advocacy strategy because the leaders that carried out those attacks, the crimes against humanity, were being killed. We released a report on Al-Ahli Hospital in November 2023 where there was no advocacy strategy and it wasn't determinative. We released my report on the Rabaa massacre in Egypt, even though it shut our office down in Egypt, because the principal thing to do is you publish the research when it's ready. But in this case, Human Rights Watch was unwilling to do so, and it comes at its core because the right of return remains this third rail, even among progressive human rights institutions. This was the first report in Human Rights Watch's history that looks holistically at the plight of Palestinian refugees, and it's the first time that a decision like this is made to shelve a report on its eve because of concerns about pragmatism. And simply, I couldn't continue when I felt these decisions were not being rooted in our normal methodology and were letting certain voices and certain political preference trump fundamental rights.
Ken Roth, I'm wondering if you could respond, but also if you could talk about what kind of pressure Human Rights Watch has been under from Israel in prior reports that you've produced.
Yeah, well, I mean, I should say that, I mean, you know, Human Rights Watch is always under pressure for whatever we say in Israel. That's just par for the course. I mean, I have an entire chapter in my book on this. You just live with it. It doesn't really matter. You know, Human Rights Watch, as I noted, has always endorsed the right to return. So, you know, there's no greater, you know, pressure on us. Now, I don't think anybody even knew this report was coming. So there was zero pressure on this report. You know, what Omar is outlining, though, is precisely why Philippe was right to send this back to the drawing board, because, you know, some Palestinian refugees may indeed have this great suffering required for it to be a crime against humanity, but a lot of them clearly don't. And that's, from my understanding, is not the nuance that the report introduced, to suggest that all 6 million Palestinian refugees get to go back to Israel, that, you know, that they're all suffering so severely that this is a crime against humanity if they don't. Or separately, you know, could the crime against humanity be satisfied by going to Palestine, you know, the West Bank or Gaza, rather than Israel? I mean, I don't know. But these are the kinds of complexities that need to be addressed rather than just rush through a 33-page report, which just is not long enough, is not detailed enough, doesn't have enough research to get into these complexities to make a compelling case. That's why I never would have allowed this report to get through the review process.
We just have 20 seconds, Omar Shakir from Amman, your final comment.
Look, I think it says something very clear that two former Human Rights Watch staffers are having a discussion about the integrity of the work and the future of the organization. Where is Philippe Loupion?
Omar Shakir, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Omar has just resigned as Israel-Palestine director at Human Rights Watch after HRW blocked a report which called Israel's denial of the right of return for Palestinians a crime against humanity. And Kenneth Roth, former executive director of Human Rights Watch. That does it for our show. On Monday, February 23rd, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 30th anniversary at Riverside Church with Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, Maria Ressa, Michael Stipe, Wynton Marsalis, and many others. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We hope to see you there. Go to democracynow.org for information.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Good morning. This is your wake-up call.
But I didn't request
it. Liver disease affects 1 in 4 Canadians.
It doesn't come with a warning. It doesn't wait for the right moment. It can happen to anyone at any time. While liver disease may be part of your story, it doesn't define it. Liver Canada is here for you before, during, and after diagnosis. Find resources, support, and hope at liver.ca. Liver Canada, by your side at every stage.